Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. San Diego County's COVID-19 outlook is finally improving, and we'll have details on today's show. Plus, the Viejas Arena at SDSU has opened as the county's latest vaccination center. This month marks the one-year anniversary of the global COVID-19 pandemic, so we reached out to people across East County and the San Diego region via social media to find out how the past year has impacted them, what their greatest challenges have been, their losses, any silver linings, and what changes in their lives they believe may become permanent. Then on Green Scene, hear about county supervisors. Historic vote to save the Star Ranch in Campbell, the largest land preservation action here in years. On People Power, hear about fundraising efforts to help restore the historic railway depot in La Mesa after it sustained major damage from a drunk driver. We'll also have a report on county actions to expand meal services for the homeless people countywide. Now, if you're looking for a getaway to get over that pandemic hump, stay tuned to hear about Camel Camp in Ramona and a camelback adventure in the Mojave Desert. We have some sad news this week on the passing of Sean Boney, a leader in the natural grocery industry and co-founder of Sprouts, also the grandson of Henry Boney, founder of the San Diego chain known as Boney's and Henry's through the years. On Crime Beat, hear about the arrest of a suspect in a series of violent assaults on residents in their homes in El Cajon. Then on 2021 Talk from Public News Service, we'll have some highlights from President Joe Biden's first press conference, where he talked about infrastructure jobs, ramping up the vaccine rollout, and possibly doing away with the Senate filibuster and more. Our newsmaker interview today is with Scott Godfredson. He's an expert on lawsuits being filed over PFAS, the forever chemicals now known to cause cancer and birth defects. He'll be talking about the impacts on firefighters, military veterans, and communities with PFAS in their water supplies, and about lawsuits seeking to bring justice to those harmed by these dangerous chemicals. On Jobs Talk, learn about a youth environmental corps being formed in San Diego County to train young people for green jobs. And from Public News Service, we'll have a report on a link between cell phone use and brain tumors. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Alexa Oslowski with a health report. San Diego County's COVID-19 outlook continues to improve as vaccinations ramp up across the region. Over 500,000 San Diego County residents, or nearly 19% of the population aged 16 and up, are now fully vaccinated, and over 30% of those eligible have received at least one vaccine. As the number of people vaccinated ramps up, the number of cases, outbreaks, and testing positivity rates are continuing to drop. As of March 23rd, the percentage of new positive COVID-19 cases was just 2% out of over 11,000 tests, with a 14-day average positivity rate of 2.7%. That is far below the target of 8%. In areas with the lowest healthy conditions, as measured by the state-mandated health equity metric, the positive test rate is about 3.4%. The case rate is currently 5.5 cases per 100,000 residents using the state's adjusted case rate. 16 community outbreaks were reported in the last week locally. That's above the goal of 7, but substantially lower than in recent weeks. And on Tuesday, the most recent day for which data was available as our show taping deadline, no new outbreaks were reported. The county qualifies to move into the less restrictive orange tier in 2 of the state's 3 metrics, but the state utilizes the most restrictive tier. So San Diego County remains in the red tier for now until case rate drops further. The state will have its next review on Tuesday when more restrictions could be lifted.
Viejas Arena at San Diego State University became the county's newest vaccination site this week after the university and the county partnered up to establish a more equitable site for communities within the college area. The site is open to the public, although 10% of the vaccines have been reserved for San Diego's hardest-hit communities. County Board of Supervisors Chairman Nathan Fletcher, in a press conference at the site, said the new vaccination location at SDSU will make sure that communities who have been historically left behind will be assured access to public health through community groups offering people who speak multiple languages, can answer questions, and offer help to get the vaccine. Project SAVE, which stands for Scheduling Assistance for Vaccine Equity, is a pilot program created to help ineligible communities gain access to the vaccine. Project SAVE has joined with representatives from the San Diego Refugee Communities Coalition and Somali Family Services of San Diego at the press conference. Nyla Ibrahim, Director of Health and Wellness from Somali Family Services of San Diego, said our communities are quite isolated by mainstream information platforms, adding that they have also been disproportionately affected by the pandemic. Viejas Arena opened with about 200 appointments a day, with the ability to expand to as many as 1,500 vaccines daily as the county receives more supply. Viejas Arena's hours for administering vaccines will be Tuesdays through Saturdays from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. To see if you're eligible for a vaccine and learn how to get one, you can visit myturn.ca.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ. A year ago, in March 2020, the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic. All of our lives changed dramatically as a result of that. COVID-19 has killed over a 500,000 Americans, caused shutdowns of schools and businesses, and forced residents to quarantine in home. We asked our readers and followers on social media to reflect on what they learned from these historic times. What was the hardest part of the last year? Were there any silver linings? And what changes in your life do you think will be permanent? Here are their responses. Patty LaBouffe in Santee says the hardest part was not being able to see my family, especially my grandchildren who live in another state. The absolute worst part was watching 500,000 Americans die, while a sizable minority thought this was an acceptable trade-off because wearing a mask was inconvenient, she says. And she adds, I learned that some people think their opinion becomes a fact because they believe it. As for lessons learned, LaBouffe says, I learned to buy good quality comfort clothing. I will continue to wear a mask in public for my personal health. I learned it's okay to use delivery services for everything and to tip drivers well. I learned that essential workers saved us, yet they are underpaid and disrespective. Julian resident Ted Berryman wrote poignantly, many of us lost a loved one during this time, many being left alone in a house that was once a home for two, he says, lamenting sitting alone at the dining room table. He adds, the sight of a comforting stranger would from time to time have been a relief. Noting that millions of Americans have endured similar losses, he reflects that despite this devastation, altogether we have become a healthier nation, more grounded in reality. Many people learned new skills in their time at home, and others took refuge outdoors or online. Patty Mooney reflects, since we had time to ride, no work to be had, we rode a couple of times a week and have become better mountain bikers. Mooney, who is in her 60s, even posted video of her triumphant rides. Raul Sandelin founded the El Cajon La Mesa Riders Group on the Nextdoor online forum. He says, it's a perfect example of how a bunch of strangers found each other during COVID and created a pretty cool literary artistic outlet. Currently, we have about 75 members and several active meetings. We've had a number of successes. Sandelin says two members finished writing TV show pilots and are now pitching their scripts, while others have taken up blogging, posted news stories, or even wrote entire novels. Tim Felton says, I learned how to grow vegetables in the garden and vastly expanded my skills in the kitchen. Former La Mesa council member Christina Licio found both good and bad during a year spent largely in isolation. I learned that people are really nasty to each other when forced into online life versus real life, she says, saying things that are simply mean, threatening to expose their neighbors, maybe even family members or friends, for any violations of quarantine-related rules. But the silver lining for Alicio has been honing her culinary skills. I invested in really nice cookware and bakeware early on and have discovered that, yes, I can still cook and do it well, she says. It spoiled me, though. I rarely eat something out that is better than I can make at home. She adds that she still goes out to support local restaurants who took the brunt of the quarantine, but she concludes, cooking at home 90% of the time is here to stay. I look forward to the day when this is over and I plan to host a big party and cook. Lemon Grove Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza reflects on the social impacts. The hardest part was not having personal connections with family and friends, she observes. No parties to hold or go to, scaled down holidays, virtual club and business meetings only, no art museum, symphony, or theater volunteer work. I really look forward to getting back to all of that in person. As for lessons learned, Councilmember Mendoza says, we need to stop being huggers and shaking hands with everyone. This is the first year I didn't get the flu. From now on, I am only hugging family and close friends. On a positive note, she adds, I picked up some good habits, which I hope to continue, walking more and journaling. Claudia Miller Bragg in Lake Morena says the hardest part was not being able to get together with family and friends. Also, listening to people call the virus a hoax or a scam. She voices concern over the division in our country over it. Being at a grocery store and watching a woman scream her rights were being taken away from her when she was asked to put on a mask. Miller Bragg also cited trouble getting veterinary appointments and having to wait outside while her pet was treated, as well as no more free samples at Barron's Market as negatives during the pandemic. But, she notes, a positive effect of it was learning to be patient and letting go of fear, reading up on the virus, and learning about herbs that boosted my immunity. Bruce Seaman in San Diego posted this terse summation of 2020. It's a year I'd rather forget. The only good thing to happen was the election of Biden. Henry LeBlanc from Spring Valley writes, I didn't realize how much of an introvert I really was at heart. But he adds, my 19-year-old daughter and I have really taken advantage of this time together and spent a lot of time reading together and talking. Really blessed time. He hopes that some employers will require workers to keep wearing masks after the pandemic is over, including cooks and food servers. Hard to believe we ever let them breathe, sneeze, cough, sniffle all over our food before, he writes. Having a background in public health and having worked in Asia after the SARS epidemic about 15 years ago when they were all wearing masks long before we were, I told my children that I'll probably keep my mask with me forever. Elizabeth Groff writes, I learned that people think they know more than scientists at the CDC. The cult of ignorance is scary. Ramona resident Penny Ferguson King is retired now, but she observes, I think a huge thing to come out of this is people's ability to work remotely or virtually. And I have a feeling some will continue to, as it does cut down on overhead costs. People save money on gas and in some cases childcare. Pollution went down with reduced traffic. I think these could be positive things to consider continuing into the future. Roger Kopuck offered an apocalyptic prediction. Yes, I see a silver lining in the COVID pandemic, he says. In the past year, we have all practiced for the coming climate change catastrophe, an ongoing disaster that will last decades and centuries, not just years. During the pandemic, we ran short of toilet paper. We all laughed about that, he recalls. But, he adds, climate change will cause food shortages. Food crops will not grow in the new high-temperature climate. There will be no vaccines or other quick fixes to make climate change go away, though snake oil salesmen will offer some. For Deborah Gostin of San Diego, the hardest part has been not seeing people, not being able to go to movies, restaurants, etc., not socializing in person, not hugging, not participating in group activities. Another negative has been working at a part-time job, she says, where I've been considered an essential employee yet exposed to non-mask wearers or ill-fitting mask wearers, customers and employees alike, and some who've tested positive for COVID. I feel I'm at a high risk whenever I go to work. But, she adds, the worst aspect of the pandemic has been watching the number of people who vanished or become gravely ill and not being able to help, other than doing my best, not to spread any germs, double masking or wearing a face shield over my mask. And knowing the toll it's taking on the nurses and doctors makes me want to hug them all. Gostin says she spent a full year watching more news than normal while life-altering events have transpired, experiencing the pros and cons of living through a pandemic and feeling like I've aged 5 to 10 years in a single year. For the future, she hopes to try and be less reactionary to the negatives that have brought me down this past year and begin again to appreciate more of what I do have and what I do love. And in the past week, she's begun getting out again to enjoy her photography hobby. Now she's excited to be eligible for the vaccine, and so she concludes, the future is looking up.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Angela Kirsch with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report. San Diego County supervisors have voted unanimously to buy the historic Star Ranch property in Campo. Acquisition of the 2,150-acre site is the county's largest acquisition of sensitive habitat, wetlands, potential passive parkland, and hiking trails in a decade. The decision marks a victory for residents of this rural community who opposed a massive housing development formerly proposed on the site. Now, the land will instead provide a permanent home for sensitive species and conserve important habitat including chaparral riparian areas and 200 acres of wetlands. The property could ultimately also connect to the Pacific Crest Trail, which runs from Mexico to Canada. The ranch is located a mile north of the U.S.-Mexico border near State Route 94 and Buckman Springs Roads. The county will pay $8.7 million for the land, of which $1.28 million will be offset by a contribution from the U.S. Navy, which operates a training base nearby and needs to maintain a buffer around its operations.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Mitchell Murphy with a People Power Report. The Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association is asking for public help to repair extensive damage to the historic La Mesa train depot caused by an allegedly drunk driver. The driver struck the portico and main entryway of this historic structure last week, also damaging parked cars nearby. Built in 1894, the La Mesa Depot Museum is La Mesa's oldest building in its original form and is the only surviving San Diego and Cuyamaca Railway Station in existence. The museum houses a steam locomotive and freight cars, a telegraph station, baggage waiting areas, providing a look at a small-town railroad lore of yesteryear. According to a Facebook post by the association, volunteers have boarded up and temporarily secured the structure from collapsing. The museum is awaiting damage repair estimates, but has already spent $1,700 to board up the sides of the building and prevent further damage. The post states, at a time when the museum is already financially stretched, we need to ask the public for help with restoration costs. A special fund has been set up for the repair costs at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum website at psrm.org/donate. You can choose the La Mesa Depot tab on the donate page if you wish to give to help cover the restoration costs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
The San Diego County Board of Supervisors voted unanimously on March 16th to execute a new 3-year agreement with the Sheriff's Department and a local nonprofit, the Lucky Duck Foundation, to prepare and distribute 1,000 daily meals to homeless people 7 days a week. The agreement expands a previous pilot program from last year between the county and Lucky Duck Foundation, in which the Sheriff's Department provided food, food preparation, and delivery service to the foundation's 2 distribution locations 3 times a week. Drew Moser, executive director of the Lucky Duck Foundation, said the Sheriff's Department's involvement has been key to the program's success and expansion from 400 to 1,000 meals a day. According to Moser, the Sheriff's Department's commercial kitchen, which already generates more than 15,000 meals a day, is a great resource that enables these meals to be made, packed, and delivered at a lower cost due to the county's buying power. Moser said after the meals are prepared by the Sheriff's Department and transported to Lucky Duck Foundation distribution sites, more than 30 outreach teams from 25 different social service agencies then blanket the county to deliver the meals to people living on the streets. According to Moser, the program has 2 goals. He says it provides nourishment and equips outreach workers with an important tool for building trust and rapport to help the homeless end their homelessness by connecting them to available resources. Moser said the program also employs formerly homeless individuals, one of whom now serves as a distribution site coordinator. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Goetz.
If you're looking for a unique experience to get you over the hump of year in COVID-19 quarantine, the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona invites you to Camel Camp, May 1st and 2nd. Campers can bring tents or RVs or stay at nearby inns and join in daytime activities that include developing camel listening, handling and training skills, milking camels, grooming camels, and camel rides. You'll also enjoy meals including a Saturday evening Mediterranean feast and a Sunday brunch. If you're up for even more adventure, Oasis Camel Dairy plans a socially distanced camel camping adventure in the Mojave Desert for those seeking a rough and tumble wilderness experience. Participants from Oasis Camel Dairy will join with other camel friends in the Mojave Desert May 3rd through 7th. For reservations and details on Camel Camp in Ramona or the Mojave Camel Camp, you can visit cameldairy.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
Sean Bodie, a leader in the natural grocery store industry with long roots in San Diego's East County, died March 8th at the age of 52 of brain cancer. Sean was the grandson of Henry Bodie, the founder of Bodie's Marketplace, later known as Henry's Marketplace. Sean worked in all aspects of the San Diego-based family business until it was sold to Wild Oats. He then moved to Arizona, where he co-founded Sprouts Farmers Market, which grew into one of the nation's biggest healthy grocery store chains. Sean served as CEO of Sprouts until his retirement last year. Born in La Mesa in 1968, Sean Bodie graduated from Grossmont High School in El Cajon, where he lettered in baseball, football, and soccer. Later, he played baseball for UCLA. He married Heather Ryan, and the couple had three daughters, Sydney, Brooke, and Morgan. Also a private pilot, Sean Bodie flew cancer patients and veterans cross-country for treatments. In addition, he enjoyed ski racing on the Mammoth Mountain Ski Team, as well as mountain biking and activities with his family. His sister, Missy Becker, says her brother was passionate about helping people. She told 10 News if he ever learned about anyone in need, he was always one of the first ones there to help and trying to find a way to help. The Bodie family founded numerous grocery businesses. After first selling peaches at a roadside stand in La Mesa, Henry Bodie founded Speedy Marts, which later sold to the Southland Corp., owner of 7-Eleven. The first convenience chain to franchise stores. He later founded Bodie's, which became Henry's and was later acquired by Sprouts. A memorial service for Sean Bodie is planned on April 17th at 1 p.m. at Secret Hills Ranch in Alpine. Instead of flowers, the Bodie family suggests donations to one of the charities that Sean supported, Challenge Center, Veterans Airlift, or Angel Flight West. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Getz with a Crime Beat report. El Cajon police have arrested 28-year-old Isaiah Ugaitafa for violent assaults in which he broke down the front doors of homes and attacked two residents, says Lieutenant Randy Solard. Ugaitafa is charged with three felonies, hot prowl burglary, assault with a deadly weapon, and elder abuse. On Friday afternoon, March 19th, officers responded to a home on South 1st Street, where a man had been seen by several residents acting strangely and talking to himself. A short time later, the suspect was seen breaking down the door of an elderly man's home and attacking the senior with a metal pole, striking him in the face before fleeing the scene. Around 3 o'clock the same day, police responded to a call nearby on Washington Heights Road, where a suspect broke down the front door of a 25-year-old woman and stabbed her with a piece of sharp wood. According to Lieutenant Solard, after a violent struggle, the young woman was able to defend herself, and the suspect fled the area on foot. Both victims in these crimes received minor injuries that did not require medical treatment. According to Solard, each incident was unprovoked and the victims were strangers to the suspect. The suspect is now in custody and was found to have a history of committing violent crimes. He was recently arrested by the El Cajon Police Department in September 2020 for robbery and resisting a peace officer with violence, both felonies. Although sentenced to 108 days in jail, Ugaitafa was released after only serving 54 days and was given summary probation for 3 years. Anyone with information on these crimes is asked to call the El Cajon Police at 619-579-3311 or San Diego Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477. You can also send tips online at sdcrimestoppers.org.
Next up, we have some national news stories from you, brought to us by Public News Services 2021 Talk.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The next major initiative is to rebuild the infrastructure, both physical and technological infrastructure, of this country.
President Joe Biden told reporters at his first formal press conference yesterday that he'll unveil details about a $3 trillion infrastructure plan in Pittsburgh next week. Notably, Biden emphasized this, and not gun control, as his next big priority. The president started by saying he now aims to get 200 million COVID-19 vaccine shots to people in his first 100 days, and he expects to run for re-election in 2024 with VP Kamala Harris. Beyond that, reporters' questions largely focused on immigration, the filibuster, voting rights, and foreign policy. Before the infrastructure announcement, Biden emphasized the need to stay competitive against powers like China, who are investing more in this.
This is a battle between the utility of democracies in the 21st century and autocracies. That's what's at stake here. We got to prove democracy works.
Biden opposes the more than 250 Republican-sponsored bills restricting voting rights in states like Georgia, which passed a sweeping bill yesterday. That legislation enforces stricter voter ID requirements, limits drop boxes, and makes it a crime to offer food or water to voters waiting in lines. Republicans argue these laws are necessary to build back trust in the electoral system. The president signaled he is willing to reform the filibuster or find other ways to pass voting rights legislation, which Republicans oppose. Senate Democrats currently need 10 Republicans to support legislation to avoid a filibuster. But there are also Democratic senators on the fence. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia wants a more moderate voting rights bill and has said he might support reforming the filibuster, although Manchin has made clear he doesn't want to get rid of it.
I'd like to circle back to immigration, please.
Much of the press conference was devoted to immigration and the situation at the southern border. Biden said his administration is opening a new military facility to house unaccompanied minors, which he hopes will improve the dire conditions thousands of young people are facing. He's also launching a program he says will quickly verify whether minors crossing are reuniting with family or not. While Biden is expelling the vast majority of adults crossing the border without documentation, he is not expelling unaccompanied immigrant children, similar to past administrations before Trump. UCLA professor Raul Hinojosa just published a book called The Trump Paradox, which, among other things, analyzes U.S. attitudes toward immigrants.
The people that don't like immigrants, that have negative attitudes about immigrants, the people in counties that voted for Donald Trump are exactly the counties where there are no immigrants.
While there is a current spike in crossings, Hinojosa notes that overall, migration across the southern border has been trending down for a long time, saying the total number of people coming across has been declining for the last 20 years. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And my very special guest today is Stan Godfredson. Stan is the owner of Atraxia Law in Rancho Bernardo here in San Diego County. His firm has been working with law firms, helping them find plaintiffs for lawsuits over PFAS. Those are the forever chemicals that have been linked to cancer and birth defects and other serious health impacts. The chemicals were made notorious in the movie Dark Waters, which focused on a lawyer's fight for justice for a town with contaminated water near a Dow chemical plant. PFAS have been found in many household products, such as Teflon pans and stain-resistant carpets. But more recently, information has emerged on the harmful health impacts of PFAS used in some of the firefighting foams, as well as on military bases. That means that veterans, firefighters, and people living on or near military bases where water contamination is an issue may be at risk. So we're going to hear a lot more about that today. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So can you start by explaining exactly what PFAS are and, you know, why we should be so concerned about these chemicals?
Yeah, so PFAS originated in the 1940s. DuPont came up with it, and it's a series of chemicals, actually. But we really know them from the nonstick pans. They didn't really start marketing that product. It was Teflon was a product until 1950s, basically, where nonstick pans kind of blew up and skillets and things like that. Prior to that, they used their technology, the Teflon technology, for the military. But what's inherently happened after the fact is that now PFAS is everywhere. I mean, it's in every water system in the world. And the question just really is, how much? Those are the kind of questions that we deal with every day.
So what are some of the specific health impacts that are linked to PFAS? I mentioned a couple of them, but especially with regard to our veterans and our firefighters who may have had such heavy exposure, what are some of the health conditions that are turning up in them that you believe are tied to PFAS?
It's cancers predominantly is what we see. With PFAS, it's been linked to breast cancer in male and females, liver cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, cervical cancer, lung cancer, leukemia, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, birth defects in women, reproductive disorders in both women and men. I just read an article this morning that came out in The Guardian regarding that. So those are the types of things that it affects. Also, there's it seems there's a link to Parkinson's disease from it as well.
Wow, so a long list of things. Now, we're recording this interview, of course, in the middle of the COVID-19 global pandemic. I saw something from your press office there that there's some concern that veterans and people who have had heavy PFAS exposure could also be at risk for perhaps worse outcomes if they get COVID-19. Can you comment on that?
Well, I mean, anytime your system is compromised, COVID has a way of getting to it. But I don't know the specifics of it. I'm not a doctor, but I know anytime, you know, your system is compromised in any way, COVID seems to react worse to it.
Yeah, weakening your immune system. Tell us about what you know about what kind of firefighting foams was this used in. Is it every firefighting foam? You know, if you've been in the path of a wildfire, do you need to worry about that? Or is this predominantly other kinds of firefighting foams used at places like military bases or airports?
The latter, actually. So what we're seeing, AFFF is the firefighting foam. It's aqueous film forming foam. It's used predominantly for petroleum-based fires. And really, the municipalities stopped using that, was ordered to stop using that. So cities, those types of things, stopped using that in 2018 when an EPA report came out that determined that there was problems with PFAS in this particular firefighting foam.
Right.
Now, with that being said, the people most at risk, I mean, military still uses that particular foam. Airports around the country have used it up until 2018 as well. But they're, you know, the people that we're really trying to target, that we see this issue with the disease portion of it, with the cancers that are sprouting up, are firefighters in particular. and then people that work at airports that have been exposed to it. So if you're just dealing with the AFFF foam, we're looking for and what we've been able to link specifically with AFFF are kidney cancers, pancreatic cancer, and testicular cancer.
So if you're a firefighter and you have one of those conditions and you have worked at airports or military bases in particular, that would be somebody these law firms would want to talk with.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people don't know. I mean, think about it. When a family member gets diagnosed, your first instinct isn't to, you know, do a Sherlock Holmes and try and figure out where it came from. I mean, you may gloss over it, but it really is care for that family.
Yeah.
And care for that family member.
Well, it's really outrageous that these are the men and women that put their lives at risk to serve our country. And then they come home and they have these horrible, you know, things happening. Why on earth is the military still using these firefighting foams, Stan? Is there not another product that would be safer on the market? Do you know?
That's a good question. I don't know why they're continuing to use that. It's effective, you know, in putting out petroleum-based fires. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been in use since the 50s. You know, it's crazy how long and how much information is out there now with the real dangers of it. Well, I have a friend that's a firefighter in Los Angeles, and I asked him about it. He works for a municipality, and they've stopped using that years ago, he said. You know, it's a dangerous type of chemical. It causes this cancer that just devastates people. So they realized that leak a long time ago. Now, why the military did not, I don't know. Why airports used it up until just recently, I don't know. You know, it's just once until a statement came out by the EPA, you know, they continued to use it. So,
yeah,
and putting people at risk.
Now, we obviously have a lot of military bases here in San Diego between the Navy and the Marines, but there's also a lot of people who live near those bases. Should they be concerned about this stuff being in their water or in the air that they breathe, for that matter?
Well, there's no question that PFAS and PFOS are everywhere. They're in every water system that's out there. Now, what it really comes down to, how much?
Yeah, I have to ask a question on that, because I know I had asked my own local water district, Helix, if they've tested for PFAS and if they have any, and they claim that they've tested for it and don't have any. Is it just that the levels are so low they might be below what some testing thresholds are, or do we not have tests to detect this stuff accurately?
It may be.
Or are they just lucky? Maybe they're one of the few that doesn't have it.
So I think they measure for thresholds, certain thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
And threshold, they do it in parts per trillion.
Yeah.
So where the danger level is 70 parts per trillion. If they're coming in less than that, it's a question if it's picked up or not. But I mean, we've seen some, you know, dealing with the firms that we deal with, we're more or less the administrative arm of some environmental firms in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen water contamination levels at 700,000 per trillion. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's just
horrifying.
That's just plain neglect. Right. Right. So those are places where big companies like DuPont, 3M are. That's just kind of the nature of it.
Now, I understand there have already been some successful lawsuits, you know, mass torts or maybe class actions or something. Can you tell us about some of the suits that have already either had court victories or settlements in favor of the plaintiffs over PFAS?
Yeah, there's a couple that come to mind. The state of Minnesota sued 3M for their PFAS levels in the water system, and they got an $850 million settlement.
Okay.
There was also a $650 million settlement for 3,500 people in the Ohio Valley region, and that was a DuPont settlement.
Yeah.
So, you know, and a lot of times we'll go out to municipalities, cities, and if they have high, some of them don't know, or there's a lack of money to be able to fix it. Maybe they do know, but it takes a lot of work to do that. in soil, it takes completely removing the soil and replacing it. So there's a lot of money involved, but that's what the firms that we work with, they go after companies like 3M and DuPont to get that money.
Good.
For those states and those cities so they can make those corrections.
Oh, that's very good. It isn't just getting money for people who've already had medical damages or losses or, you know, wrongful deaths, but also to fix the problem going forward so that future generations won't be saddled with the same problems.
That's true.
Very good.
Yep, that's true.
So tell us about the criteria. If people are listening to this and maybe they have cancer or one of these conditions, or they're worried that they could have been exposed to PFAS, particularly firefighters, military, active duty military or veterans, or people living very close to military bases or airports. What are the criteria for joining in one of these lawsuits, Stan? What are you looking for your clients out there?
Well, it varies a little bit. If we know that it's coming through a water system like we're seeing on military bases, we'll look for, first of all, what did you get? What type of cancer were you hit with? Or, you know, was there birth defects that you know, things like that. So we'll look for clusters of those diseases. So if somebody calls us and said, hey, I have cervical cancer and I was at Pendleton, you know, between, I don't know, 1970 and 1974, something like that. That's a case that we'll look at. So our job is to kind of screen, make sure that individuals fit the criteria that the lawyers are telling us that fits, and then pass that information on to the law firm so the law firm can kind of pick up the conversation. They can have a real attorney-client privilege and start, you know, hashing it out even more. So in particular, we'll look for the disease. We'll look for the place of exposure. If the place of exposure is a military base or a airport, that's precisely what we're looking for in these types of individual cases. And then the time frame is kind of strange on these. So anybody that was on base or at an airport between 1952 and 1987 are the cases that we're looking at.
Okay.
And so if somebody was on base at that time, and you know, there's that part of cancers that take a long time to progress. So that's kind of the reason for that time frame. So the lawyers can actually go back and tie it in to that particular place and time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, what about firefighters who may have been exposed to firefighting foam, but also I understand this, that PFAS were also used in some firefighting gear. So that residue of it has been found in many fire stations where they went in to measure for it.
Right. Again, it comes down to what is the parts per trillion? What's the parts of PFAS? And is it at a level where we can go in and say, hey, this is an issue? Most of the time on clothing and things like that, that's a very hard argument to make. You know, I mean, if there was foam being sprayed and things like that, the attorneys that we work with can make that connection.
Yeah.
And make it work.
Stan, another question for you. It's fine to talk about PFAS theoretically, but to your knowledge, have dangerously high levels of PFAS actually been found anywhere in San Diego County?
Yes. There's been some readings taken. Obviously, Pendleton, big military base, they've had some high readings. And then there's a little known place called Coronado Warner Springs that has also been tested. That's right between Santa Isabel and Temecula.
So here in East County.
It's here in East County. That's right. Yeah.
And that was the water that tested high? Do you know how high it was?
That was the water that tested high. So the last reading was in 2016. And I don't know where it's at now, but the parts per trillion at that point were 35 parts per trillion. So that's a little below the threshold, but still.
How widespread is that? I mean, should people who live in say, Warner Springs be concerned about that, or the other little towns that are nearby there? Or is it primarily the people that were actually working on this military base out there?
From the data that we know, it's primarily working on this little base. You know, this stuff travels too. There's a reservoir out there. There's a community out there. So, you know, people just have to be careful. Unfortunately, for a legal remedy to really help, we have to see the disease. We have to see clusters of cancer.
So if you're in Warner Springs, or you've worked on that military base, or you've worked at Pendleton, or you live near Pendleton, and you have some of these types of cancers or children with birth defects that PFAS are known to cause, then you may want to, you know, be in touch with Stan here and find out if that could be what caused it.
But by all means, and err on the side of caution. If you have any questions, call us. If we don't know the answer, we'll get you in touch with an attorney that can kind of walk you through it. One of the things that we kind of take pride in is we like to work with the attorneys that are actually doing the work, not the guys that you see on TV and all of that, the advertising guys. We go kind of right to the source. So the guys that are heading up these multi-district litigations, the guys that are actually litigating, the guys that actually have the inside track that can really help people.
Okay. Were these PFAS used in military operations overseas? Is it only veterans who were serving on military bases that used them that are at risk, or were they also utilized, you know, in combat zones, for example, or bases overseas? Do you know?
That I don't know. I would assume on U.S. military bases overseas that, you know, what happens here, I was in the military, and I know what happens here also happens in overseas on the military bases. So to think that, you know, it doesn't fit is, I think that's a false premise.
Okay.
I think they definitely had used, especially the AFFF foam. Yeah, I mean, you got to look at that. What we're looking at is really the locally U.S. It's because of the laws that are in other countries.
Got it. So where can our listeners get more information about this, Stan, or if they want to reach out and contact you if they think they might, you know, be a potential plaintiff? But how would they do that?
They could go to atraxialaw.com. That's A-T-R-A-X-I-A, atraxialaw.com. All in word.com. And there's a section on PFAS water contamination. There's a form there. There's a phone number they can call. And then what we do is just ask them a series of questions, much like the questions we just went over. You know, what was your occupation? What were you affected with? What were you diagnosed with? You know, those types of things. And we just run through it. And if everything kind of clicks yes for us, then we'll get them to sign a power of attorney with the firm mm-hmm. that we work with, which is the Environmental Litigation Group based out of Birmingham, Alabama. And then they follow up and make the connections and really open up the conversation.
Very good.
So
The law firm, the environmental law firm in Alabama that you're working with, okay, they had some notable wins either in PFAS or other environmental cases that were landmark.
Yes. The managing attorney there is a guy named Greg Cade. And Greg's background is science and chemistry. He's a chemical hygienist before he was a lawyer, but he's gone against Monsanto and, you know, in that area for water contamination. And most of his big verdicts, they're forced not to divulge. So, but he has extensive credibility in the place, extensive amount of litigating these toxic torts and, you know, an extensive win rate with them.
Very good. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about PFAS or the growing body of PFAS litigation, Stan?
You know, I think right now it's just coming to light with most individuals. Most people haven't heard of PFAS, but recently I've seen a bunch of articles on it talking about these things that we have just spoke about. So litigation has always kind of been at the forefront to get real information out, because we're able to, the law firms are able to get information out of the companies, and a lot of it's very damning. So I would say to whoever was listening to this, look, if you have a cancer, if you've been diagnosed with life-threatening types of disease, you know, always kind of try and backtrack a little bit, because there may really be some connection here. A lot of the people that we talk to don't have any idea that that's what may have caused it. We do a lot of work with asbestos as well, and it's the same type of deal. You know, you just don't know what you have. You're diagnosed, or your dad was diagnosed, or your grandfather was diagnosed, whoever it was, brother, sister, mother, but it's very hard to pinpoint exactly where that came from.
Yeah, I've known people who had asbestos-related cancers, again, from military service, from, you know, serving in ship that, yep, you know, where they were contaminated with it.
Yeah, and it's heartbreaking. You know, I've talked with people personally and it's a family issue. It's not just a, you know, I think people think that the law industry is kind of cold-hearted and just out, you know, to make a buck. That's not necessarily the case. There are certainly lawyers out there that do that. I'm not saying there isn't. But in this case, I mean, I think a lot of thought has gone to the families and how we can make that better for individual families, you know, because it's a family issue. It really affects people at the core. If their breadwinner has cancer and not long to live, I mean, that's a really serious family issue.
Oh, absolutely.
What I think the lawyers look at, the ones that we work with, you know, they look at those issues and they do their best in getting some settlements that may be able to help the families. But again, it's just you got to kind of hit them where it hurts with large companies, and that's in their pocketbooks, to get them to change.
Yeah, and one hopes that maybe eventually legislatively this will be addressed. The PFAS have been banned in some products now, not all. There's some progress there, but it's a matter of, I guess, also speaking out, listeners, and letting your legislators at the state and the federal level know that you're concerned about this and that you would like to see, you know, an end to the use of these chemicals wherever possible, so we don't just keep seeing these kinds of things, you know, generation after generation, putting our communities, our firefighters, and our military men and women at risk.
Very true.
Well, Stan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy.
San Diego County's Board of Supervisors voted 5-0 in support of the Youth Environmental Recreation Corps, a program aimed to provide youth with skills training and opportunities to gain work experience in the growing sector of green economies. The county staff will have 90 days to report back to supervisors with a fully detailed plan to provide green jobs for our region's young people. The program will be open to San Diego County residents ages 16 to 24. Youth Will has been working closely with Supervisor Lawson Reamer and the Invest in San Diego Families Coalition to promote this initiative and ensure the youth voice is represented in improving access to green space and green work opportunities. Supervisors Tara Lawson-Reamer and Nora Vargas proposed the Corps to support career readiness, workforce development, and mentorship. The program will provide paid employment opportunities for low-income youths through county departments, with a focus on careers in the green economy. Supervisor Lawson-Reamer says mentors helped me flourish as a young person, but if I were growing up in isolation during a global pandemic, I don't know if I would be so lucky. At a time when opportunity and social interaction has disappeared for many students and entry-level workers, this youth corps will help young people jumpstart their careers with paid positions to help them get a foothold in the green economy. Sophia Haidara, youth organizer at YouthWill, praised the decision. She says, youth is our future, and in order to have a growing, vibrant, and sustainable San Diego, we must invest in their opportunities. The Youth Environmental Recreation Corps will not only invest in their future, but prioritize the youth of today who are still suffering from COVID-19 impacts, social isolation, job losses, health impacts, and more. But, she adds, our work doesn't stop here. We will continue to open equitable pathways to ensure all young people who want to work have work. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A former director of the National Center for Environmental Health at the CDC says there's a high probability that radio frequency radiation from cell phones causes certain rare but often malignant brain tumors in humans. Dr. Christopher Portier submitted his findings as part of a lawsuit by patients and families against multiple cell phone manufacturers and carriers. Ellie Mark's husband, Alan, just had a second surgery to remove tumors caused, experts they consulted say, by cell phone use. She joined the lawsuit and founded the nonprofit California Brain Tumor Association to get the word out.
The industry is working with the FCC to hide the truth, and we're tired of it. And people need to be aware of the truth that there is enough science now to say that cell phones are indeed causing lethal brain tumors.
The cell phone manufacturers maintain their products are safe and comply with all regulations. Monique Solomon, another plaintiff, says her late husband, Andy, fought cancer for 5 years, passing at age 42, suffering from a tumor she believes was caused by the phone he used while driving around selling commercial real estate.
And he had the Motorola big battery pack to his ear probably 8 to 10 hours a day for years. You know, his scar went above his ear and was like a horseshoe down right around the back of his ear, exactly where he held a cell phone.
Dr. Deborah Davis, president of the Environmental Health Trust and an expert on RF radiation, notes that tests the government uses to evaluate cell phone safety are 25 years old.
We test our phones with a dummy, with a spacer against his head. So we don't even put the phone next to the head. We don't put the phone next to the body when it's tested. And as a consequence, the tests are rigged. They don't reflect real exposures.
A study done by the National Toxicology Program found that RF radiation causes brain and heart tumors in rats. Davis says she fears a surge in cases in humans over the next few decades.
Brain cancer is now the leading cancer in children. It has increased dramatically in young adults. Older people have not been using phones as long. And brain cancer has a latency of 40 years.
Davis says she advises people to avoid putting a cell phone up to their head or carrying it on their body and to turn it off or put it on airplane mode at night. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.